Welcome to the July 2016 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. This issue is on the topic of infamous neurological injuries and disease, cases and events of historical, political, cultural, and scientific impact. In this podcast, we hear a conversation between topic editor Dr. Mark Pruhl of the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, and Dr. Chris Lofer of Bronson Neuroscience Center in Kalamazoo, Michigan. They discuss Dr. Slofer and colleagues' article, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, the head injury that may have prolonged the Second World War, which appears in this month's issue.
This is Dr. Mark Pruhl, and I'm the Neurosurgery Research Chairman at the Barrow Neurological Institute and a member of the Executive Committee of the Section on History of Neurological Surgery for a long time, and so is Chris, who is a past chair of that section and longtime Executive Committee member, and so we're really happy to speak to Chris today about his work. Chris is an enthusiastic historian, one of the very best historians that is in the group, in this section, and in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, and has done a great job leading the expanse of knowledge and breakfast seminars and that type of thing. So I'll ask him for a little bit of an introduction in a minute, but just to say that Chris's paper on Field Marshal Rommel, which is really a great read, just an entertaining story, entertaining history, and really informative history, was chosen to be the podcast for this history issue of the Neurosurgical Focus that comes out in July 2016. And so, Chris, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, and we can get to it.
Sure. Thanks for the kind words there, Mark. As Mark mentioned, I'm Chris Slofer. I'm a neurosurgeon in Kalamazoo, Michigan, the Bronson Neuroscience Institute, and then also a member of the faculty at Western Michigan's Homer Stryker School of Medicine. I've been interested in history in general for a long time, and then the history of neurological surgery and medical history probably for the last, 12 or 14 years, I suppose, and worked in a number of different fields. As you're aware, this work came out, a neurosurgical focus issue that looks at famous and infamous neurological injuries and diseases and the impacts that those events had on the history that ensued. And I think Rommel is interesting in that regard. Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, one of the most respected commanders of the German military in the Second World War, on both sides, really. He was well thought of by certainly Adolf Hitler and the public in Germany. He had the respect of a lot of his fellow commanders, though he also found himself at odds with some of those commanders. And then he was respected by his opponents as well. And there's a lot of stories where he showed great compassion to captured troops and regard to his enemy commanders and so forth. And so he was well thought of on both sides. Some of that, may have been partially legend, but I think there's no doubt that he was a man of honor and a well-respected guy in the German military.
Yeah, really a great read, Chris. And tell us about the other two authors on the paper. I think Heather Furman and Jeffrey Mullen.
They are both in Cleveland. Dr. Mullen is a resident at the Cleveland Clinic. He became interested in history, and I met him when the section visited Mount Vernon last year at the meeting in Washington. And Heather's a medical student at Case Western Reserve, and they have helped me with this project. They've also been co-authors on a couple of abstracts that were presented here most recently in Chicago, and hopefully those will be forthcoming abstracts as well. So as we try to get more and more people interested in the history of medicine and the history of neurological surgery, these are a couple of up-and-comers that we hope to keep involved.
That's great. So just to let the audience, I guess, know, Chris and I go back a long way. We're friends, so we're going to try to treat this as a very informal conversation where the audience can also learn about this paper. We're discussing how neurological disease and injury affects culture and history. And it seems that very much of a poignant events that go on, especially in war or battle or generals, in combat, these sorts of things have really a great effect on what can happen. And what's your take on that? I mean, certainly we do have other situations that occur in world events that are interrupted, but it seems that these situations that occur in war are sort of, you know, have acute effects for us.
Yeah, I don't think you have to look very far to find examples of those. You know, Rommel is certainly one, and we'll delve into that in more detail, I'm certain. But, there's Admiral Nelson and his neurological injury with a thoracic spine wound that ultimately took his life. And there's General Kutuzov that you've written on, which is really astounding, a man that was shot in the head twice in two separate battles, separated by some amount of time, and lived through both of them. But it certainly is part of his story. Dr. Goodrich's article on King Henry being, lanced in the head in a jousting accident, and the change in monarchy that ensued after that. And so I think you don't have to look very hard to find military leaders and heads of state and so forth that have had neurological injuries, and that has played a role in history.
Right. So tell us about Erwin Johannes Eugen Rommel and his sort of early years. What kind of a boy was he? What kind of a family did he grow up in?
Well, his father served in the military as well as a lieutenant, and Rommel himself was drawn to engineering and mathematics, and that was his original plan. But he ultimately decided to join the military. He became a cadet and a student at the War Academy in Danzig, and then ultimately spent his whole career with the military. His first experience as far as war itself was concerned was in the First World War, where he served with some distinction, won some awards and so forth for his service there. And then he stayed on in the interwar years. The German military was obviously very curtailed between the First and the Second World War, but he remained in the military and served as a commandant at a couple of the different military schools, and he wrote a book on infantry tactics that was well-regarded and is still around even to this day. And then as the Second World War came along, he had an opportunity to become known to Hitler, and he did so, and that started a relationship that really, helped his career along. And Hitler was, as a autocrat, essentially, was able to keep moving him along and promoting him in his career and giving him more and more responsibility, and that there's no doubt that helped his advancement.
Right. I was surprised in reading in your paper that there were a number of war academies, I guess, in Germany between the First and Second World War that were, it looks like, fairly important academies that Rommel was an instructor in and achieved some increase in rank also during these times. I mean, there's the War Academy in Potsdam, there's the Army Infantry School in Dresden, he was in the War Academy in Wiener Neustadt, and so he's really coming up through the ranks, and in fact, he even bypasses the rank of Brigadier General and goes straight to Major General from, I guess, being a colonel.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that was at the time, when he was becoming more involved with Hitler, and he became in charge of Hitler's personal security at that point, both in Czechoslovakia and Poland and so forth. And I think that helped his career along. He certainly used that access to Hitler to request an armored division and to move into the armored corps, before which he really didn't have any experience in that regard. But Hitler gave him the opportunity to command a panzer division. He took over the 7th Panzer Division in 1940 and worked in France at that time, and then ultimately, obviously, to Africa, where he gained a lot of fame and respect.
Right. Is Hitler promoting him based on his military acumen, or does Hitler think that he can control Rommel or put Rommel in, as a somebody he can rely on, like a Himmler or a Goebbels or somebody like this? Or is really Hitler looking at him as somebody who can, lead combat, lead troops?
Well, I think, it's probably too hard to speak with, with facts behind you about Hitler's thinking in a lot of ways. I think he drew the attention of Hitler. He was bold in how he approached Hitler. He had his cadets were going to be inspected by Hitler, and he found out that Hitler planned to bring basically his own troops to provide his security while he was at Rommel's compound, and Rommel took offense at that. He felt that that was an insult to his troops, and so he refused to present them. and you know, Goebbels and can't remember whether it was Goebbels and Himmler both were there, and they agreed this was an insult, and they allowed Rommel to provide the security, and then they used that opportunity to introduce him to Hitler. So I think he probably was taken with that boldness that he would stand up and say, "No, you're insulting my men by not allowing us to provide your security while you're in our place," and that probably started the ball rolling. And then there's no doubt Rommel was successful in his endeavors, and that probably built on it. I never got the feeling in reading about Rommel that he was necessarily, you know, the yes man that some of Hitler's other confidants were, Himmler and Goebbels and so forth. I think he showed respect for the command. He was very conscious of the chain of command, and that he worked for Hitler, and that Hitler was the commander, and I think he took that seriously. And so in that regard, he probably wouldn't dispute Hitler, but there were many times, especially as the war went on, where he disagreed with Hitler and suggested other routes that most of the time or many of the times weren't taken, and then after that he would salute and do his job.
It seems like that he was a favorite of his troops, that his troops really were proud of their commander, that he interacted with them quite a bit to increase their leadership, and you've written about that. Can you tell us about the things that Rommel would do with his troops?
Well, I think he was well regarded by his troops. He would lobby for them to receive extra rations, and he would take his meals in the field mess halls with his troops. He wouldn't have an officer's mess or the like that where he was served special food. He wanted them to think that he was in the same situation as they. And he was frequently visible at the front. He, you know, there's a long list of generals throughout history who, you know, lead from the front, as it were. And he was that kind of a general. He didn't sit back and never was seen. He was in the, you know, in the mold of Patton as well on the other side, that was visible to his troops, and at least gave the impression that he also was in danger and was willing to take some of those risks that he was asking his men to take. And I think those all did things to increase his esteem within his organization.
Yeah, it seems that he has also a feeling about Germany's state after the war, that I guess perhaps related to what Germany will need after the war in terms of economic power and economic ability, that he seems to understand that this situation of this huge war is really taking an impact on Germany.
Well, I think as the war goes on, certainly as the war starts, he's a military man, and he is out to bring about a military victory, if at all possible. But I think as time goes on, it's pretty well established in his writings and in stories from witnesses that he becomes less confident that a military victory can happen. Once the invasion of Normandy takes place in almost, you know, this date almost exactly, in June 6th. Now, after a week or two or a month or two goes by and that invasion is well established, the beachhead is solid, and the Allies have been able to reinforce and bring more and more heavy armor, and they're there to stay, and they're not going to be able to be pushed back into the ocean, which of course was the hope, that with the Atlantic Wall defenses, that they, any invasion would just be repelled immediately. And once it was clear that wasn't going to happen, I think Rommel became convinced that the war in France, at least, was not winnable, and he started thinking about bringing about peace. And you know, he didn't expect any exact mercy as far as surrender is concerned, but he hoped for a fair arrangement for peace. There's a quote where he was talking about that he thought that Hitler might, you know, fight to the point where every German had given their lives, or words to that effect. And he makes the comment that Germany will need these men after the war. You know, he was looking down the road a bit, that not only the economic future of the country and so forth, but the leadership of the country, some of the people that he was serving with, that those folks were going to be needed for the future of Germany. There had to be somebody left after the war.
Right. Do you think that he starts thinking about what the immediate consequences of the war, what the state of Germany is, and what the state of battles that he is in and that he's faced with, for instance, in North Africa, in Libya, where he wants to shorten the front from some humongously wide 400 miles and is thinking to kind of concentrate it to 100 miles. And you write that he's also thinking about requesting, or he does request, to have soldiers move to Italy, where they would defend against an invasion of Southern Europe. Do you think that that's the sort of beginning of that awakening? I mean, is that what this is for him?
Well, I'm not sure about that as far as the whole war is concerned. I think the Africa campaign is interesting. You know, Rommel came to Africa with some success behind him in France, and then was put in charge of the Africa Corps. And he initially had great success. You know, the Battle of Kasserine Pass, where he defeated the Americans for their first big battle in Africa, and really was doing well. But it didn't last very long, actually. You know, he then quickly, Montgomery and the British troops were on his tail, and they eventually, you know, were going to defeat Rommel. And I think it did become clear to him that it was not winnable. He proposed to Hitler in one of the many times he then disagreed about strategy, that the front was too long and that the only way that they were going to be able to defend it and not be roundly defeated was to shorten the front and defend a smaller area. That wasn't acceptable to Hitler. He insisted that they continue on as they had been. He then approached Hitler about evacuating some of those troops, I think, to keep them from capture and defeat, and in a way falling back to Italy to try to prevent the next step of the war, where he saw the Allies defeating him in Africa and then coming to Europe again. And that was somewhat squashed by Hitler. He didn't think that was a good idea. He really didn't seem to be too interested in any thoughts of a retreat or defeat. He once he came to a strategy that he thought was the right one, he wasn't really interested in deviating from that, regardless of the facts in front of him.
Right. So he leaves Africa, and then he comes to Italy for a summer in 1943, and then you write he was a military advisor at Hitler's headquarters. And then he begins to, it looks like, be involved in defending against an Allied invasion of Europe. And he seems to see more clearly what the problems are of defending Europe, defending France, versus von Rundstedt, who seems to have a little bit more sway, I guess. Is that with Hitler?
I think so. And he and von Rundstedt had a long history of not, you know, doing very well together and not having the best relationship. And how things go, I think that von Rundstedt probably honestly disagreed with him on what was the most likely course for the Allies to take as far as the site of their invasion and so forth. But when you disagree with somebody and you have a long-standing conflict and perhaps some degree of jealousy between the people with respect to their superiors, to Hitler and the high command, you know, sometimes you get into disagreeing just to disagree and to make a statement as to how your theory is different. But von Rundstedt felt that the likely site of invasion was at Calais, the shortest point across the English Channel. In the meantime, the Americans and the British were doing everything they could to encourage that view. That's where they assigned George Patton, who was kind of on the outs with the command at the time, and he was assigned to the so-called U.S. First Army Group, where he was essentially commanding a ghost regiment there across from Calais and trying to convince the Germans that he was readying the invasion force, when in fact it was really taking place down the coast towards Normandy, and that was where Rommel felt was the most likely. So they disagreed on where the most likely site of invasion was. They also disagreed a little on how the invasion was to be fought. Rommel didn't want to let the Allies get a beachhold. He felt that if they got a beachhold and were able to hold it and reinforce that, then they would be unstoppable, partially because of their industrial might that was behind them at that point, and the really aggressive bombing campaign, which had begun to decimate the German industrial base and made it harder for them to wage war as time went on. So von Rundstedt, he disagreed. He thought that they should let them come on in and establish a beachhead and then bring his panzer divisions sweeping in to try to cut them off from the beach and flank them and have a grand victory. And of course, as events ultimately showed, Rommel was correct. I don't know how much that could have been predicted up front, but that was the two differing opinions within the command structure of the Atlantic Wall, von Rundstedt and Rommel. And as it turns out, Rommel was correct in his analysis.
Right. I mean, he's correct very quickly, as you write. About 5 weeks after the invasion of Normandy, Rommel is telling Hitler that military victory on the Western Front is now impossible and that France is not defendable. I mean, Rommel seems to have a great amount of tactical insight as to what should happen, and very, very quickly is communicating to Hitler, and I guess Hitler is just not getting it or has other agenda items.
Yeah, I think it's hard to picture. It depends on what you think of Hitler in general. You know, he was by no means a military genius or a great statistician of his own right, and he really was dependent on his commanders, but yet he also retained ultimate control and made decisions however he was going to. And, you know, if you believe Hitler was not in control of his faculties, then perhaps you say that he did things whether they were rational or not. I don't know that we know that. We do know that he really was unable to consider any type of retreat or surrender or defeat or even regrouping and changing of his basic strategy. And that inflexibility in waging war doesn't seem to work out very well.
Right. And so is it during this time that then Rommel then begins to really take account of what's happening in Germany? You write about his disillusionment with all the various internal struggles that are going on with the monstrous and inhuman action toward people, mostly Jews, and this sort of thing. And you write about the stubborn military proceedings also that is happening.
Yeah, I think there's pretty good evidence that Rommel, just I think disillusionment, as we titled that paragraph, is accurate. I think he began to question the underlying logic of why there was the war that was going on, and I'm sure that was hard as a career military guy and dedicated to his service and his country. I'm sure that was difficult for him to come to the conclusion that maybe the underlying reason for continuing the war was probably not only futile, but questioned whether it was reasonable to begin with. So, some of the people that were around started to raise the possibility of trying to get rid of Hitler, or at least trying to end the war. Now, the proof of how much Rommel actually knew and how much he actually had those conversations, it's hard to judge. He didn't write a lot about that himself. Now, there's quotes of him criticizing Hitler, there are quotes of him suggesting that the war is lost, and he was concerned that Hitler was going to run the country into the ground before it got through to him that the war was lost. But there's nowhere in Rommel's papers where he recorded, I agree with these people who ought to overthrow and kill Hitler. Now, of course, why would he write that down somewhere for someone to find?
Sure,
I don't think that's surprising, but I do think that you're wander off into speculation. But I think there's reasonable evidence that he had become disillusioned with the war and with the leadership, and he thought that the country probably over the long haul was better served with ending the war. So he became involved in Karl Strohlin's conspiracy against Hitler.
And what did Rommel really agree to, do you think, with those conspirators? You suggest that perhaps they were approaching him about being a post-war leader or a post-surrender leader. Is that what you think Rommel was thinking or had agreed to?
Well, I think that the conspirators recognized that Rommel was very popular with the German public. He had been turned into, a Patton or an Eisenhower or a Montgomery-style person for their respective countries. He was well-regarded by the public, well-respected, almost a myth-like figure, and I think that they thought that there's going to need to be somebody like that around to lend their weight to this movement. People might not necessarily know some of the other conspirators, but Rommel was a household name. He was well publicized, in all of the newspapers, and so all of the Germans knew who he was. And the thinking was that if he was behind the movement, then that would gain popular support as well. And while it doesn't sound like Rommel knew directly, there are a couple of the conspirators, Strohlin and so forth, who suggested that they might move to make Rommel the head of the state after the overthrow of Hitler. And He says that he never told Rommel that, but that was his thinking all along. But I think that was the, you know, our premise in the article, and it's always fun with history to speculate. It allows you to say, gosh, what would have happened if this, you know, if this was different and that were different? And the thinking here is, what if Rommel had been around and the attempt to overthrow Hitler had succeeded either with killing him or without killing him, then what would have happened? And would Rommel have had the force of personality to draw the country around him and convince them that, okay, it's time to make peace and take our lumps from the Allies for the war, but to move forward rather than continue this war that he saw as futile?
Right. And Rommel is not really on site in Rostenburg when the conspirators failed in their bombing attempt, which was, you write, was July 20. He's actually in the Normandy area on July 17. So do you think that Rommel was really an inner part of these conspirators, or had they sort of come to him as a person that we're going to go to after we've pulled off this event, hopefully, of killing Hitler, and you'll be a person that we will come to? Or is Rommel really a part of the intricate planning for this?
I think probably Rommel had his plate full with worrying about defending the Western Front. I think that Rommel was probably approached and they wanted his support because, again, they recognized his popularity and his influence with the German people and of course, the military. And so they didn't want to get in a position where they attempted to overthrow Hitler and then have the public and the military turn against them. And so I think they viewed Rommel as somebody who was necessary for the next step to make the overall change of government succeed.
And that seems to be consistent with Rommel's concentration on what he needed to do, which I'm sure he, even though things are deteriorating in Germany, he still feels very much an allegiance to the German army and his soldiers and his, you know, command staff. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question of that. He had a great allegiance to his people and his army and his country.
Yeah. Now we're going to get into the situation and the events of his assassination, that of Rommel, when he's badly wounded in an air attack. And this part of the papers are really, I think, the story is really, as you've written it, is a gripping piece of history. I can just kind of see it, and I found your paper finally in this afternoon, and I was able to pull up the pictures that you also have used to illustrate this really great piece of history, and they're really interesting pictures. You know, I look at Rommel as your first illustration. Rommel's a really handsome guy, and I hope that people, when they're, you know, hearing this podcast, will go and read this article and look at the picture. I mean, your picture of Rommel is when he's a field marshal is, I mean, you can just see this guy. He looks like somebody who would be a soldier, like the general you or the field marshal that you would want to have command you.
Yeah, I think that's right. He's that's one of the official portraits. The thinking is that's approximately 1943. He is in full uniform with his Knight's Cross and his Pour le Mérite, and he's looking kind of to the side. He has a strong, very strong jutting chin, and he looks like he could take a blow on the chin. You know, he's a very solid man, and you look at that photograph and say, yeah, this man is a leader, and he's strong for you. And I think you're right. I think that's a great picture. There are a lot of photographs of Rommel out there, but that's an official one. I think that it's I'm sure he approved of it as it was official portrait. I think that this probably also conveyed the image that the German military and the German government wanted to have about Rommel. They wanted him to appear larger than life and very John Wayne-like, as it were.
Right. So you set the stage vividly for us as he's riding in the car. You describe who's riding in what seat in the car, why he has to even drive, because Hitler won't let him fly, because various high commanders are being somehow killed in air crashes. And so Rommel is riding. And this has to be something that, you know, everybody in this car, as they're, you know, driving through Normandy area, they know that there are Allied aircraft patrolling all through the area. And so on July 17, an attack comes, a strafing comes. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so Rommel and his aides and some of his advisors take off, and they go to visit a couple of headquarters further west than his headquarters. And they take off in a car. As you say, they're not allowed to fly within the theater. For all practical purposes at this point, there's not a lot of German air power, and so the American and British, and to be fair, the Canadian South African air power there is the dominant force. And so there's a lot of danger from the air. And so there had been other generals shot down in planes and so forth. And so allegedly Hitler himself forbid his top generals from traveling via air at that point, and he was in a car. And it was a big open convertible staff car, and it was a car full of men. There was a number of people, one of which whose job was to sit in the middle looking backwards, and he was keeping an eye out for aircraft. So this was a very well-understood danger. But they take off, and they're driving actually back towards their headquarters, and they get a report of some aircraft in the area, so they take a side road to kind of dive away from the main thoroughfare where they expect there to be fighter aircraft. Unfortunately, one of the, fortunately, depending on your point of view, one of the fighters sees them, and they come diving down for the car. And there are a number of different stories, whether it was one aircraft or two aircraft. In the movie from the 50s, I'm sure you've seen The Desert Fox with James Mason as
yes,
Rommel and
yeah.
So forth. They're shown two aircraft, and I think that's consistent with a couple of the stories anyway. And the plane comes down the road, along the road, and they start firing at a range of about 500 yards, and the driver is hit in the left arm with that first pass, and that causes him ultimately to lose control of the car. Car goes off the road, and it runs into a tree stump and is turned over. Rommel was sitting in the passenger seat in the front, and he was looking backwards, and he was thrown from the car and landed in the road, and he's immediately unconscious. He has lacerations. And another strafing pass comes by, and the other people in the party eventually, after the strafing is done, come out to Rommel. They carry him off the street, and they take him to a cottage, which still stands, and it's by the side of the road there, a home of a farmer. So that was the attack, anyway.
Right. And you write that there's some discrepancy as to who can take credit for this as far as pilots go and planes, that there are reports that an American P-47 flew down and did the strafing, and then you write of some of the other pilots, a British Typhoon, but you say that it looks like the most well-documented of the reports is that the aircraft that fired on Field Marshal Rommel was Charles Fox. It was a Canadian and probably flying a British Spitfire.
A Spitfire is a British single-engine fighter. It had a top speed of about 360 miles an hour, and its typical armament was 850 caliber Browning machine guns. It was a formidable and fast aircraft. So that's probably the most likely as far as, which plane did the damage. The initial report was that this was an American P-47, but then ultimately, Captain Lang, Rommel's aide that was in the car, reported that it was a British fighter. And there is a Charlie Fox's log from flying that day. It talks about being in that area. And there is, at approximately, I believe, 1 p.m., roughly speaking, he reports that they strafed a German staff car and it was destroyed.
Right.
And then this logbook, somebody out to the side, I've seen a photograph of this, but somebody out to the side has written Rommel question mark, and then in another hand right below that is yes, exclamation point. And so I don't have any idea who wrote those notations, but there is good proof that Charlie Fox was in his Spitfire and in that area at the appropriate time and fired on a staff car. They had no idea, of course, that it was Rommel at the time.
Sure, yeah. Well, and that second question, so I'm just looking up a little bit. It looks like it was at least a 20-millimeter cannon. So when that driver was hit, that's a really significant injury, and no wonder that the car went off the road. I would guess that there must have been other shells that hit the car. Would you say that was true?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. I would think that, you know, if these were 50 caliber machine guns, they have a cycle rate of several hundred rounds a minute. And if there were eight of them in a Spitfire, that's a lot of rounds coming at you at one time. So I think that you would expect that the rounds would stitch themselves up the car and into the driver and on out the other side.
Right. Now, was it known that, you know, there may be high-ranking officers driving around of the Germans? I mean, do you think that the Allies had any indication that this was somebody important? I mean, obviously, it's a staff car. It has to be somebody important riding in there. Do you think that Americans had known anything about this, or that the Allies, the British or Canadians?
When in reading about the different theories of who flew the plane, there are orders out there that these fighters were up hunting for staff cars and hunting for the command. That was what they were out there doing. So I think it was well known, and I'm sure there's every reason to believe that that the Allies knew that the commanders were driving around. They weren't flying around, and it was, like you said, I don't think it was anything subtle. It was if you've seen these cars, they're big, open convertible cars. It's not like it was a Jeep with a couple of soldiers in it. I think it was probably pretty clear that this was somebody of importance. And like I said, I don't think there's any thinking that anyone knew, you know, was out hunting for Rommel himself that day. But
sure. Were there any other vehicles with Rommel at the time?
Not that I'm aware of.
Was that typical for that period, driving you know, a staff car, especially somebody important like Rommel? Was where he was going a short drive?
No, overall, if I remember correctly, it's something like 90 miles or so from where his headquarters at La Roche-Guyon to where the places he was going to visit. It wasn't close. Now his headquarters was still quite a ways behind the front line. So perhaps he felt he was, you know, was safe there as far as the enemy is concerned. But as he was driving to those other headquarters, those were closer to the Normandy beaches and the Normandy front. So, you know, he was getting closer to the enemy. I don't know what their procedure was as far as escorts or other vehicles. I didn't get the feeling that they had air escorts at all.
I see. So the driver, Sergeant Daniel, is hit in the shoulder and the left arm, and then he loses control of the car, and you write that the car swerves into a tree stump on the right side of the road and then careens into a ditch. And Rommel was looking backwards, I guess, holding on to the back door or whatever, and then he's thrown from the car.
Yeah, that's
then,
right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, he's thrown out of the car. Captain Lang, as the car was careening out of control, jumped free. I believe Daniel stayed in the car with the wreck. That Daniel was the driver. I don't know about Sergeant Holka, the other soldier there, but he survived. He wasn't injured, and actually Holka wasn't injured, and so they went out and carried Rommel off the road.
Right. So, and then in your illustration for this, I know that you had to really hunt for something that illustrated. There's some interesting history about your figure that it's kind of curious. The illustration that you provided from the newspaper, that two pager. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that the way this came about is I ran across a history article on a German website, and it was actually within the website of a German television station. And there was a photograph of this wrecked staff car. It's covered with grass, and it's right side up, but it's beat up pretty badly. And off to the side is a general that's identified as a Panzer general named Sepp Dietrich, and it's alleged that this is Rommel's staff car after it was strafed. And so you know, I thought, great, that's, you know, this is a picture that would really add to this article. You can show, you know, show Rommel's car and that damage it had and so forth. But I didn't have the source. And so eventually I found that the photograph was from a German kind of propaganda newspaper out of Berlin called Illustrator Beobachter. And this photograph, I ultimately tracked down the issue that was in. And once we had that issue, we tried to find a copy of it. And it's astounding what people keep and end up being archived. To me, it's amazing that somebody saw fit to keep this propaganda newspaper from 1944, and it ends up in the library collection of the University of Michigan, which is, you know, sitting an hour and a half from where I'm at right now. And so I went to the University of Michigan, and you can walk in and request this paper, and they bring it out to you. And so I have a photograph of the entire page out of that newspaper. And it, as you read the captions, and I had help with the translation. My German is weak enough that I certainly need help. But it's pretty clear that this entire page is written about the other general, Sepp Dietrich. And so this is Dietrich's car. It was Dietrich's wreck. He wasn't injured. And I think that the way that this confusion happened is at the very top of that page, there's another photograph of Sepp Dietrich and Erwin Rommel walking in a field in Normandy, both looking at the camera. And I think that that probably led people to assume then that that article was about Rommel and it was his car. But it's pretty clear from the captions that's not the case. And I found that, I included it anyway, because I think it's really fascinating that that's been alleged. And then when you go back to the original source, that's not the case.
Right. Well, and it shows the sort of physicality of what you might expect from a bad wreck of a large staff car. It's just, I thought it's a really, I hope people will look at those illustrations. So Rommel is thrown from the car, and then you write that he's got a severe head injury. So tell us about his injury and then his subsequent treatments for that and how he's evaluated and what happens.
Sure. So, as I mentioned, Rommel was taken to just a farmer's house next door to where the accident happened. Captain Helmut Lang, his aide, jumps on a bicycle that the farmer owns and rides to the next town, returns in about 45 minutes with a car. They put Rommel and Sergeant Daniel in this car, and they take him to asylum, a old folks home, essentially, in the town of Livero. And there he comes into contact with the first medical provider, and that's a pharmacist by the name of Marcel Lassin. And you know, as I think probably most of our listeners know, in France, pharmacists are have a little bit more expanded duties than we typically have here in the United States. They do treat primarily some medical problems. That history is actually very interesting too, but that goes back into the 1600s and 1700s. So this pharmacist comes along and is asked to look after him, and he diagnoses Rommel with, and there's a quote that says, a fracture of the petrous part of the left temporal bone, a perforation of the left tympanic membrane with blood coming from the external auditory canal. He also describes a fracture through the left orbital arch. He described his pulse as weak and thready, and that he was in deep coma. That's a pretty good assessment for a pharmacist, wasn't a neurosurgeon, or wasn't even a military surgeon that would have seen many of these injuries. So I thought that was interesting unto itself. You know, he goes on and he starts treating Rommel. He gives him two ampules of camphorated oil intramuscularly, which is it serves as a cardiac stimulant in that setting.
Yep.
Not used anymore. You know, camphorated oil is considered poisonous, but it's had a long and complicated medical use over the years, and at this time was a reasonable thing to do. And then he advised that they take Rommel and Sergeant Daniel to the Luftwaffe hospital at Bernay, which was about 25 miles away. So that was their next step.
Right, so they actually get to Bernay.
They do get to Bernay.
And then tell us about Professor Esch and the actual neurosurgical assessment.
So he gets to Bernay, which is about 25 miles away. That hospital has also been in existence for several hundred years, and has been since the German invasion of France a couple years earlier. That served as the Luftwaffe, the Air Force hospital there. And so Rommel is taken there. Daniel is taken there. Daniel is given a transfusion. They take skull x-rays, Rommel, and they wait on the neurosurgical consultant, Professor Esch, to come by. It's not clear whether he got there that night or it was the next morning. He had to come from Paris, which was about 90 miles. Regardless, he arrived and he described Rommel as restless. He gave him some morphine, chlorhydrate, barbiturates, a lot of sedation for somebody with a head injury and no airway protection and so forth. But that was his initial treatment. He noticed cerebral spinal fluid coming out of his ear. He performed a lumbar puncture and described clear fluid with no blood. So he didn't have any subarachnoid hemorrhage. He described a complete third nerve palsy, but no major motor deficit. He then speculated that there was no hematoma, either subdural or extradural, and concluded that the skull fracture was not depressed and didn't recommend any surgical intervention, as Rommel still responded to sensory stimuli. It's interesting, those x-rays exist. Dr. Richard Davis, who's a neurosurgeon in Philadelphia, wrote an article on Rommel back in 67 or 68. 1968, and he published these x-rays of Rommel that was obtained from Esch, and I would say that the quality of them is astoundingly poor, perhaps like you would expect in the middle of a war, but I would defy you to find a fracture on those x-rays, and so it's very interesting that they made, you know, really complex diagnosis with that modality.
Yeah, and so it seems that Esch pretty well assessed him and, you know, probably and did not recommend any surgical intervention, as you say. That was probably the right course of action. Would you say so?
Yeah, I think so, as much as we can know. If we believe him that he had no hematoma, that this was a closed head injury, perhaps with some contusions, but no significant extraaxial blood, I think that was probably correct. They describe the fracture a little bit further as going from the skull base through the zygoma and the ethmoid cells and up to the cella. And so, you know, boy, there was some serious force involved to break that floor of the intracranial fossa.
Was Esch a military surgeon?
Yeah, I see. I think so. He was a consultant to the Luftwaffe.
I see. Okay. So I just pulled up on a map where Rommel was strafed and then to get to Bernay, and it's at least about 40 minutes. So back in the 40s during the war, this had to be a significant journey with two people who are severely injured, and luckily that they even made it, I guess, to the hospital is something that had to require some skilled attention also from the other aid that were traveling with Rommel and with Daniel to make sure that, you know, at least Rommel didn't die. Sergeant Daniel obviously is very seriously injured as well from that strafing. So Rommel recovers, and then things sort of start happening. The situation of the conspirators, it looks like, is not too far back in Rommel's history, and it comes back to affect his family as well as him. So tell us about that.
Rommel's from Bernay. He starts to recover to some degree. They move him to Paris, and he is there for a few weeks after that. And then he begins to worry about being captured by the Allies. The Allies continue to advance through France, and Rommel requests or demands that he be transferred to his home in western Germany, near Stuttgart and Mainz and so forth, and in western Germany. And then they transfer him back home. He's accompanied by Dr. Esch and another military and army surgeon, and he's taken back to his home. And he gets to his home and is reunited with his wife, of course, his son, who's 15 years old at the time, Manfred, and Manfred is in the military as well. And he was allowed to come home to meet his father. And Manfred describes how his father was when he got there. And this is a quote from Manfred Rommel, which says, "My father, his left eye covered with a black bandage, sat in an armchair beside a low coffee table. The left half of his face had been crushed by the weight of the blow he had received. He raised himself shakily to his feet, and we exchanged greetings. Quote, I still get headaches, and my left eye is closed and will not move, but it will all get better," end quote. So that was Manfred's description of his father coming home. He was then treated by an ophthalmologist and a neurosurgeon at the University Clinic Tübingen, which is not far away. They are impressed with the fact that he had survived his injury, and they leave him alone to some degree here for a few weeks while he recovers. However, as you say, 3 days after the accident, there's the attempt on Hitler's life. As we know, it was not successful. Hitler wasn't killed in the explosion, and when it was clear that he survived, he was not happy with that, as you might imagine, and he went after the conspirators. And many of the officers involved committed suicide for fear of being captured by Hitler and what might happen after that. Hitler's colleagues certainly managed to capture others, and then as it came along, Rommel fell under suspicion. And Rommel heard of this and warned that other conspirators had implicated him, and so he was concerned about for his safety as well. he's called to Berlin, and he refuses to go. He is afraid that much like another officer was called to Berlin and died on the way, he's afraid he wouldn't reach Berlin alive. So he gets one of his physicians to basically say that he's not well enough to travel at that time. Unfortunately, the Führer didn't take no very lightly, and he sent some of his other generals to see Rommel at home.
Right. So do you think that Rommel was contemplating suicide, even if Hitler hadn't been so insistent on, we'll bring it to you instead of, you know, you coming to us to Berlin to commit suicide, we'll come to you? I mean, do you think that Rommel was thinking about this anyway?
I don't think there's any evidence necessarily that he thought at that point that Hitler was going to request his suicide. I think that there were officers who had committed suicide, but I'm not sure that they did it under duress. I think they did it as much as anything out of fear of being captured by Hitler and what might take place if they were captured. So I don't think that necessarily Rommel had that as a plan, and I think that's apparent by the fact that he didn't initially just commit suicide once these two men came to see him. It took some talking. And we can get into that, but they offered him a couple of different options, and then with some consideration, he found suicide to be the better choice.
Right, and General Bergdorf, you write, is the one that informs Rommel that he's been suspected of being involved, and of course, you write also that the Rommel family knew throughout September that they were being observed by the Gestapo, and so that must have been a great trial for the Rommel family. I mean, a 15-year-old son who is in the military, Rommel's wife. I mean, they sound like a very sound family in many ways. I mean, I'm sure that Frau Rommel must have held many of the same views as her husband. They must have been a family that, you know, was very worried about Germany, and so now this is happening after this, you know, incredible accident. So tell us then, I guess, about this last day.
Well, I think that he and his family were worried. They had been told that they were being suspected. They knew that their home was being watched, and they were under suspicion. When he was called to Berlin, he spoke with Professor Albrecht, who was the ophthalmologist caring for him, about that, and Albrecht said that Rommel wasn't well enough to travel, and then he tried to convince Rommel to come to his clinic, that he would be safe there and unknown there. They wouldn't reveal that he was there. Apparently, Rommel agreed to that he and his wife would move a couple of days hence on the 20th, but it didn't get that far, as you describe. Two other German generals, Meisel and Bergdorf, came to Rommel's on Hallam on the 14th. They met privately in his study for about an hour. Apparently, they told Rommel that he was suspected of being involved in the bombing by some of the convicted people, and the conspirators had claimed him to be the chief of state of a new Germany if the uprising had been successful. Rommel denied those, but when he came out of the meeting, he went to his wife, and she reported his quotation as being, "I've come to say goodbye. In a quarter of an hour, I shall be dead. The Führer has given me the choice of taking a poison or being dragged before the people's court. They have the poison. They say it will take only 3 seconds to act." That's the end of the quote. But the implication was that if he committed suicide, he would be given a state funeral. It would be said that he had died of his injuries, and his family would be taken care of. They wouldn't be persecuted in any way. However, if he opted for trial and he was convicted, which was a foregone conclusion, he would be executed, and he could expect his family also to not be treated kindly.
Right.
So because of that, he opted for suicide as the solution, and his son and his aide suggested that they try to fight to escape and so forth, and Rommel knew that that wasn't going to work, that there were plenty of people around, and that he wouldn't survive that either. So he dressed in his uniform and went with the other German generals and a driver who was wearing a Gestapo uniform, and they drove not very far away, and everybody got out of the car except for Bergdorf and Rommel, and then 10 minutes later they came back and Rommel was dead and was taken to a local hospital to say that he was dead.
Right. So, yeah, you write about, I think, Major Aldinger, who's been with him for a long time, or Captain Aldinger, as his sort of aide-de-camp, who has been with him for, you write about him in earlier parts of the paper. He's sounds like a very loyal aide-de-camp to Rommel, was very concerned, as well as obviously his family, to say the least. And then you write about, you know, as I was reading the paper, I was wondering whether Rommel was actually going to get a state funeral or not. It seems he did. Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. To the government's credit, they kept their word. He died. It published that he had died as a result of his injuries received in France, and he was given a state's funeral and buried with honors. And his family wasn't persecuted at all. Although, you know, the war did end shortly thereafter, so, you know, who knows what might have come. But there is a photograph that's not included in the article, but of a wreath that is 12 or 13 feet tall. It's taller. It's probably not quite twice the height of the people carrying it, of Hitler's wreath that he sent to Rommel's funeral. And so he was treated like a war hero and really published that he died of his war wounds. And so they kept their word.
Where was that funeral held? Was that held in Berlin, or where was that funeral, and where is Rommel buried?
That's a good question. Well, Rommel is buried in near Ulm, which is his home,
yeah.
His home of Ulm. And where that funeral, where the I did include a photograph of his funeral with him being drawn on a caisson and so forth, and all of the crowd saluting him and so forth, a very moving photograph. I think that is in Berlin, but I'm not positive.
In your discussion, you write about, some of the historians and some of the other people that have written articles about him. What do you think we should take away from this? And what's your final appraisal of Field Marshal Rommel and this event that took place that probably did affect the outcome of the war?
Yeah, I think the another fun thing about writing history is you're free to disagree, and you have historians that have written on both sides of this topic. But Brigadier Desmond Young, who's a British historian and was a Rommel biographer, he met Rommel once. He was a member of the British force fighting against Rommel in the Africa Corps and was captured actually and met Rommel as a prisoner of war. He admired Rommel greatly, and he described that. Rommel was destined for great things if he could have wrested control from Hitler and so forth, and it would have seen to the success of the country. Dr. Davis, who, as I mentioned earlier, wrote an article on Rommel, describes that had he been able, he would have rallied the German army to overthrow Hitler in the Third Reich, and probably would have chosen that course whether or not the explosion claimed Hitler as its victim and so forth. So he certainly, after his research, felt that Rommel really would have turned the course of the war had he been able to participate. But as he describes, quote, "the need for a calm, resolute leader was essential, and as Rommel lay unconscious at Bernay, none could be found with the required courage and boldness." And so he also feels that Rommel would have played a big role. Now, there are others who disagree with that. There's Charles Marshall, who is a German-born but American military officer who served in, I believe, the 6th Corps in the intelligence area, and he described that Rommel was, it may be a military genius, but he was criticized for his execution. He got tied up in details. He wasn't very good at delegating, and he suggested that Rommel might not be a tremendously effective head of state had he survived. Similarly, there's a British historian by the name of Ronald Lewin that also felt that he probably wouldn't have been a successful leader in that regard. And I don't know. I think that it's hard to judge the validity of all of those different points of view. My view is somewhat like Charles Douglas Home, who was an editor of the Times and also wrote about Rommel, that Rommel was a good military commander, and more than anything, he was adept at putting together a very good leadership team. He had his aide Hans Spiegel, who was his almost alter ego, where Rommel was knew nothing of the arts and was somewhat unrefined socially. Spiegel actually was an intellectual and multilingual and a great organizer and took care of many of the administrative details in Rommel's command. So I think that the thinking is that Rommel was not a perfect leader by any means, but would have put together a team that might have been successful. I think that he carried weight with the German public. He carried weight and had a good reputation with his enemies. days. I think it would have, if they had succeeded in overthrowing Hitler and he could have stood at the head of the German public and convinced them that the war should be over, he would have been well received, I think, by the British and the Americans and probably the Russians to negotiate a peace and may have brought about the end of the war earlier. And that's our thesis, actually, that we posed through the whole article, is that the war might have ended a year earlier if he hadn't been involved in that accident.
Right. Well, it seems that, you know, we romanticize some of these figures. You write that there's the Rommel's aide-de-camp, Heinz Werner Schmidt, who wrote with Rommel in the desert, said that he had, or wrote reservations that he said, "I do not describe to the theory that Rommel was a superman. Close to him, I found him much more unimaginative and stolid than the romanticized pictures that have been drawn of him by both friend and foe." But I think that's probably true of many historical figures that we investigate and that we write about and that, you know, the general public comes to know. But I think, you know, I think what you've done a great job on is writing a piece that I think really teaches us a lot about World War II, which we don't have a lot of surviving people that have fought in World War II any longer. That's a generation that is dying out. I know from my own father teaching telling me about stories, you know, he is no longer with me, but I cherish those stories of World War II. I think that you've written a really interesting piece that brings also not only the historical but the personal side of Rommel's family and his description of his general persona and his accomplishments. And I think a fair assessment also is to include things or, you know, writings or opinions that, you know, may be not exactly praiseworthy of Rommel, but try to assess him fairly. So I really compliment you on this article. I think it's a fun read, and I hope that the readership of Neurosurgical Focus will go to the article, not just the podcast, and see the photographs that you've included, and the one that shows his complete third nerve palsy also, which you've included, and Rommel's right eye is looking straight at you in that photograph, which I kind of looked at that photograph, and Rommel says to me through that photograph, "I'm still here."
Yeah,
and I'm still Erwin Rommel.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's certainly nobody could argue that, like any man, that Rommel was perfect and would be the perfect leader and so forth. But I think he definitely was a charismatic leader. He was a popular leader. He is like George Patton on the other side. There's a great story about Eisenhower walking with a journalist across the grounds of West Point and coming upon Patton's statue, you know, far after the war. And the man says to General Eisenhower, "General Patton, he was quite a legendary man," and Eisenhower replied back, "Yes, mostly a legend," implying that there's, you know, that not everything that you hear is true. And you know, and Eisenhower was a friend of Patton's going back long before the war, so he was in a position to know. And I think that's a lesson that we talk about, you and I have spoken about before, with other figures, you know, Harvey Cushing, Erwin Rommel, all of these people. They weren't perfect in their own right. They had their good points and bad points like everyone else, but they, all of them, did have the force of leadership and dedication to their field and contributed to history.
Well, that's what makes it fun to write about, too. So, well, thank you, Chris. Fun time. I know I learned a lot. Great article. And as I say, I hope the readership of the Neurosurgical Focus will enjoy it.
Yeah, I do, too. There are a lot of good articles there, and I hope they enjoy the issue. It was fun to be involved in. So thank you, too, Mark.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our podcast for the July issue of Neurosurgical Focus. This also concludes the monthly podcast program. In August, we will begin publishing video abstracts for select articles. For more information, please visit the August Focus issue at thejns.org. The August topic will be cervical spondylotic myelopathy with and without OPLL.